Well, I hope that you all have had a wonderful week and a great weekend. I went to a memorial service yesterday for an old friend, a friend of our whole family. She lived at her last years at Bethany, and the memorial service was wonderful because she was fully present there in the memories that people shared, and you could just feel her loving and cheerful personality. So that was part of my weekend. I hope you all had a good weekend. What else can I report to you? Deviled eggs are best in the spring. I've come to that conclusion. Spring is the time for deviled eggs.
Oh, but they're good any
time. Oh, they're good any time. You're quite right.
I hope you don't feel that we're insensitive having to leave early, but there are four or five of us, but we're in the choir.
You're in the choir. I know. And when it comes time for you to leave, I always realize that I need to wrap things up. That I'm talking too long. Generations of students have given me as graduation gifts wristwatches. But it doesn't do any good because I can never remember to wear them. And so they sit at home in a drawer. Right? One time I was teaching at a church, and I guess I was going on too long. A lady at the back started waving a white flag, at me, surrendering. Well, the time has come for us to talk, and as you can tell, I'm really completely absorbed in this subject of conflict between the generations, and what can we do about it? I've been now for a couple of years exploring the hypothesis that toward the end of the first or the beginning of the second century, a report, the Greek word is akoe, something heard, a report reached Rome that the church in Corinth was in revolt against its presbyters, its elders. Some of them, we don't know how many, probably no more than three or four, but some of the elders had been deposed from office. And as I have analyzed the early Christian writing called First Clement, I've come to the conclusion that the instigators of the revolt, the agents who removed the old presbyters, were a group of young men. Now, in order to understand the dynamics of what happened, how did it happen? And more importantly, why? What were their motives, right? In order to understand that, the how and the why, I've spent some time learning about generational conflict more broadly. And that's clearly important for us today, because that's what we're experiencing, right? The Occupy Wall Street movement was mainly young people. The Bernie Sanders movement was mainly young people. Many young people today feel that they are at a disadvantage, that they are shut out by the system. And many of the protests all around the world in the last few years have been protests by young people. So there is a contemporary interest in my historical work. I'm not going to pretend, right, that this is totally disinterested. I'm interested in our own situation. So, how did it happen at Corinth, and why? As you can see my little outline for today, I would like to begin talking about the causes of generational conflict. And here I'm talking about the persistent and regular causes of friction between the generations. And then we will talk about the mechanisms. How did the young and the old fight it out? Right? And then finally we will talk about the circumstances. When did this happen? Under what condition did the young revolt against the rule of the old? In general, throughout human history, the rule of society has been, and it is concisely articulated by Plutarch, a contemporary of the author of First Clement. Plutarch says in his essay on whether an old man should continue to be active in politics, right? Well, that's important for us. This year, 2016, we had a choice in the election between what? A 69-year-old and a 70-year-old. And we chose the 70-year-old. And if we had chosen Bernie Sanders, he was what? 73 or something. Yeah, he was beyond 70. So, of course, they say the 60. 60 is the new 40. Right. But Plutarch, in his essay on whether an old man should continue to be active in political life, Plutarch formulates the rule of society, and I think he's right. You know, in my own research, he's telling the truth when he says it is the right of the old to rule, and it is the duty of the young to obey. That's the standard rule. At the end of antiquity, there was a scholar who collected quotations. If any of you have done some public speaking, there's a popular book now, or has been for many years, called Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, right? My father gave me a copy of that when I was a young man, and when I was aspiring to be a public speaker. Bartlett's Familiar Quotations. You've seen it, right? So, in the ancient world, the ancient Bartlett was a man named Stobaeus, and he collected quotations. The title of his book is Florilegium. You know what that means? Can you guess? A bunch of flowers, right? A bouquet of flowers. Those are his quotations. And the largest chapter, he collected quotations on every area of human life. Anger, grief, marriage, everything, just like Bartlett. The largest chapter in his bunch of flowers is a chapter entitled On the Duty of the Young to Obey Their Parents and Elders. So that's the norm in the ancient world. Okay, what were the persistent causes of conflict between the young and the old? The first one has to do with the law itself. Roman law gave the father, the male head of the household, something called patria potestas. Without knowing Latin, you can see what that means. It's what? Potestas, the power of the father, the paternal power. And among the Romans, fathers had more power than, I think, in any society in history. And the Romans were aware of that themselves. The great Roman lawyer, the jurist named Gaius. Gaius, in his Institutes, which is a big law book, Gaius says, no people on earth give fathers as much power over their children as we Romans have. And then he ticks off the elements of that power. First, the power over life and death. Do you know what he's referring to? A Roman father had the right to what? Yes. Now, this was exercised mainly when? At birth. Exactly. If a family had too many mouths to feed, or if there was some potential conflict over inheritance, or if the child was what?
Deformed,
right? There was a little ritual in the Roman household. The midwife or a female member of the family brought the child and laid it at the feet of the father. And if the child was chosen to live, the father did what? Picked it up. And if he left it laying there, what?
To die.
Right. Most of those children were thrown into the latrine. Isn't that terrible? In Rome, archaeologists who have excavated latrines in places like Rome and Caesarea, at the very bottom of the latrine, guess what they found? Infant skeletons. Just heartbreaking. Other children were taken to a slave market and sold if they were not wanted. That was a big business in the ancient world, the buying and selling of unwanted children. Now, there are not many documented instances of fathers exercising the right over life and death beyond infancy. Not many. But there are a few. And some of them come from the misty past, right, of Rome. The founder of the Roman Republic, Junius Brutus, right? The ancestor of the Brutus who did what? Killed Caesar. Yeah, so his ancestor. Back in the 500s B.C., he found out that two of his sons were plotting to bring the old king, Tarquinius Superbus. What a name, right? I'm so glad my mother didn't name me Tarquinius Superbus. They were plotting to bring him back to the throne of Rome. And so Junius Brutus dragged his two sons into the forum, and guess what he did? He killed them. He beheaded his two sons. Now, those are legendary stories. Who knows whether that really happened? But in the historical period, in the broad light of history, there was a man named Fulvius. Fulvius was an aristocrat, and he discovered that his 20-something son, who is described as the smartest and best-looking young man of the late Republic. And Fulvius discovered that his son had left home and gone to join the rebellion, being led by Catiline. Catiline was a threadbare aristocrat who mobilized discontented young people to overthrow the Republic. Cicero made his reputation, as you may know, by squashing the revolt of Catiline. And Fulvius discovered that his son had left home and was on his way north, Diane, up toward the Sabine Hills where we had our little house, to join the rebellion under Catiline. And Fulvius sent a group of his household slaves. They apprehended the boy in mid-flight. They brought him back home, and his father killed him. Wow. And that happened in the broad light of day. And Mr. Fulvius was not prosecuted by the Roman law because he was exercising what? His rights as a father, yeah. So the power of life and death. For the most part, this power was felt not in the exercise of it, but in the dark shadow that it cast, right? It was a limiting concept. It was a potential that could be invoked, but seldom was.
And Mom had nothing to do with it.
Mom had nothing to do with it. No, the power resided only in the Father. Now, in terms of everyday life, the power of the Father was exercised in the monopoly over family property. Everything in a family belonged to the head of the household, including anything that his sons might earn. That belonged to him too. And as long as the old man lived, his sons or his grandsons, even if what they wanted was just a candy bar, you know, it's so hard for Diane and I, even on a diet, to resist Snicker bars. Well, if you were living in an ancient Roman family, even if you wanted a 100-calorie, you know, they sell them like that now, bar of Snickers, you would have to go do what?
Ask
your dad. Or if you had a living grandfather, right, everything belonged to him. This was a incredible power over family life, that all property belonged to the Father. Yes?
Didn't you talk about last week saying that the wife in the family brought a dowry?
Yes, that's exactly right. That was the only independent source or pot of money in a Roman family. It was the dowry that the mother brought. And we will see in a few minutes how that worked out in generational conflict. You might be wondering, if the father had a monopoly over family property, how did young men manage their lives? Especially if they lived where? Outside the family home. And that did happen. You know, of course, young men grew up, and by the age of 27 or 28, they got married, so they established their own household. But even then, all of their property belonged to whom? The old dad. So how did they manage? Well, you might be thinking that perhaps at a certain age, young Roman men were emancipated by their fathers so that they could accumulate their own property. In fact, that was almost never done. And young men did not seek it because it had a negative consequence. If you were emancipated, well, guess what? No inheritance. Emancipation removed you from succession to inheritance. So very few people chose that option. Another expedient that you might be thinking about is, what about borrowing? Couldn't a young man go to a money lender or to a rich friend and get some money that his father did not control? It turns out that didn't work either. Because who remained, according to law, who remained liable for all of the son's debts? The father did. Yeah, it's like that today. My younger son had such a wonderful education at Oberlin College and at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. When he graduated from Oberlin, tuition, room, and board was $52,000 a year. Wow. And he was there 5 years. He was on the 5-year plan, right? Well, you can do the math, right? So in the ancient world, young men who borrowed money, their fathers were still liable. And this created a real legal crisis, which was finally addressed by the old emperor Claudius. Claudius passed a law forbidding moneylenders from lending money to young men whose fathers were still alive. Right? He forbade it. People still did it. They broke the law anyway. But Vespasian, the man who destroyed Jerusalem in the year 70, the emperor Vespasian, he put a stop to it because what Vespasian said was that any money lenders who lent money to a young man whose father was still alive, that money was forfeit. They couldn't collect on it. Right? If the father refused to pay the debt, they lost. So the money lending to sons stopped in the late first century. A possible source of financial or economic independence, sort of, for young men was something called the peculium. Does anyone know what this is? This is an allowance, right? That a father would give his son, just as we do today. But of course, whether the peculium actually gave young men any sort of economic independence and agency depended on what?
How much it was.
Whether the father was generous or stingy. My younger son, his favorite story in the New Testament. Anytime that scripture is read in church or told, that story is told, there's a tear in his eyes. It's the story of the widow's mites. He identifies with that woman who has what? Only two pennies. Right? That's terrible, isn't it? Maybe I'm a stingy father. But some fathers were more generous. Cicero, for example. Cicero was not born an aristocrat. He was the son of a country farmer. And when he came to Rome and tried to become the magistrate, the consul of Rome, he was a nouveau riche, you might say, a social climber. And he wanted his son, young Marcus, to have all the advantages that he did not have growing up. So he sent his son to Athens to get the very best Ivy League Greek education. And Cicero wrote to his rich friend, Atticus, and he boasted. He said, I give my son a very generous allowance. But if you read the letters of the young Marcus, Marcus Jr., oh, it's a different story. Guess what he says? My pockets are empty. My father gives me nothing. And of course, Cicero responded, I gave you plenty, but you spent it all on parties, drinks, and girls. Does any of that sound familiar? So we come back to the point that you made. The only independent source of money for young men in a Roman family was their mother's dowry. And this turns out to be very important, actually. Seneca, you know Seneca, the great Stoic moralist? He was fabulously rich. He was the Bill Gates of the mid-first century. He owned land in Britain. My ancestors were probably his slaves. Anyway, Seneca, in one of his letters to his mother's name was Marcia, he praises her because he says that all through his young manhood, it was his mother that provided for his education and his political career and his travel. She was using what? Her dowry. Yeah. Cicero when young Marcus complains that he doesn't have enough money for the lifestyle that he wants to lead in Athens, Cicero writes to his son and gives him what piece of advice? Ask your mother. That's exactly what he says. He writes back to him and he says, ask your mother. She has money. Right. So gifts from mothers or stepmothers were basically the only legitimate source of economic independence for a young man until his father what? Died. That's right. And that explains a lot. Because next week, when we try to reconstruct what happened in the church at Corinth, we're going to discover that in the two places where the author of 1 Clement comes close to providing a description of what happened, the young rascals are condemned, and in the next breath, the author condemns who? Women. And mothers. So there's clearly some sort of support and collusion. I should mention one more cause of conflict or source of money for young men, and that is disreputable occupations. So young men could do what? They could take up with a rich widow. Yeah, there are cases of that. There are lots of cases of that in the ancient world, and we know about them because they led to lawsuits. When the rich widow died, who got her money? Well, you would think the young man would get it, but remember, anything the young man earns, according to law, belongs to whom? His father. So there are several cases in the ancient world of young men, law cases that we know a lot about, young men who took up with rich old women, and when the women died, the father did what?
Grabbed
the money. Right. And, of course, there are other disreputable occupations. Gambling. You hear a lot about that in the literature. Prostitution. The Emperor Domitian, when he was young, was relatively poor. And there was a Roman senator named Claudius Pollio, who, when he gave banquets for the amusement of his guest, would take out of a drawer a letter that had been sent to him by the young Domitian before he became emperor, offering to sell his body to Claudius Pollio. Oh, terrible, isn't it? The Roman world. Plutarch, in his essay on the education of children, says that one of the consequences of the monopoly over family property by fathers was that young men who didn't have money of their own were reduced to what? Stealing. Stealing family property. Getting money behind the back of their mother and father. And there's lots of talk about that. Now, to bring all of this to a conclusion, I think what we have to conclude is that for practical purposes, young men in Roman families lacked economic independence and juridical agency. Sextus Empiricus, who is a Greek writer, writing at the beginning of the 2nd century, he says that Roman children had a status not very different from slaves. How did you know that? That's exactly right. And he said that the only chance they have of freedom is if their father dies. Now, of course, this picture is complicated by demography. You remember what we said last week about the average age at death? What was it? 27? 28? So, As a result of that, half of the young men would have been fatherless by the age of 20. Two-thirds would have had no father by the age of 25. And a staggering three-fourths would have had no father by the age of 30. Now, you might think that that would help, that that would diminish the conflict, because young men were becoming financially independent of their fathers between the ages of 20 and 30. But this, as it turns out, generated conflict in a different direction, horizontally. Suppose you're a young man whose stingy father is still alive, and your friends, some of your posse, your group, their fathers are dead. You look at those young men with what?
Envy.
Envy. And you yourself become more dissatisfied with the inequity of your condition. Yes?
I know life, things were different then, but to what extent was money a part of society relative to what it is today? Because, you know, I'm not saying they were on a barter system or, you know, but was money prevalent
yes.
like it is now?
Yes, very much, right. What they didn't have was public institutions. There was no such thing as a federal bank, right? Banking was private in those days. It was in the hands of individuals. But yes, the whole Roman economy was fully monetized. And money was a big deal. Okay, so we've started talking about the causes of conflict. Some of those were legal. What were the mechanisms of conflict? The most powerful weapon in a father's arsenal was what?
Disinheritance.
Exactly right. Ex hereditatio is the Latin term. The Greek term, apokeiruxis. Do you know what that means? Apokeiruxis means to proclaim a separation. And it was a public ceremony. The father had the power to disinherit his son, but he couldn't do it privately. You had to go before whom? A judge, a magistrate. And you had to make a public proclamation that you were disinheriting, separating from your son, and you had to give reasons for it. So there were some limitations to it, but it is the major topic. It's the largest topic in a genre of ancient writings called declamations. You know what these are? These are practice speeches for young men who are being trained for the law courts. And by the way, the reason that this is so important for our understanding of the dynamics of generational conflict, declamations are the only literature written exclusively for the young, for young men. All these declamations were part of the legal training of young men to go play a role in public life. And the number one topic in those declamations is disinheritance. Let me give a couple of examples. So, here's one declamation. A young man began to feel sorry for his poor uncle. His uncle had fallen on hard times. So the young man helped him out using his what? Allowance, his pocket money from his father. His father found out that he had helped his poor brother, and guess what the father did? He disinherited the son because he didn't approve of it. Here's another declamation. A young man was disinherited because he refused to marry the rich old woman that his father had picked out for him. and in the declamation, in the speech, the young man says, "Father, you have no control over my emotions. I don't love this woman that you picked." And I can really relate to that. My father had some girls he thought I should have married, and instead I chose that beautiful redhead. And it led to... It led to disinheritance. It sure did. In my case. So disinheritance was the number one weapon in a father's arsenal. The most dramatic or interesting case of this is a case that is related to us by Lucian of Samosata. Lucian of Samosata was a satirist. Who's that guy? Colbert? He's like the ancient Colbert. And he wrote a satire called Disowned. And in this satire, a young man was disowned by his father because he was disobedient, didn't obey his father. So the father dragged him before the magistrate and disowned him. The young man left home and somehow got himself trained as a medical doctor. Well, one day he got a message through one of his friends that his father was suffering from insanity. His father was out of his mind. And so the young man found a cure. He found a drug. He came back home. His friends advised him against it. They said, "If that drug doesn't work and your father dies, you'll be convicted of what? Patricide." Yeah, they will think that, you know, you bore him a grudge because he disowned you. But the young man goes on anyway. He goes home, administers the drug. His father is cured. So his father, in gratitude, does what? Adopts him back into the family. Then the boy's stepmother, the father's second wife, becomes insane. I don't know what there was in the water they were drinking. But she becomes insane. And his father says, "You need to treat her the same way you treated me." The son examines her and concludes that he cannot cure her form of insanity, that it's incurable. Guess what the father does? Drags his son back into court and disinherits him a second time. And the speech that Lucian puts into the mouth of this poor disowned young man is so heartbreaking. You know, the young man says, "Never has a son who loved so much been so hurt by his father." When I read that speech, I heard echoes of my own young manhood. So disinheritance is the major weapon in a father's arsenal. Lots of young men evidently were disinherited. About 100 years before First Clement, there was a young man in Rome who became famous. He was known as the shepherd of the disowned. Do you know what he did? He gathered other young men who had been what? Disowned or disinherited, and formed a group of them to agitate, to advocate for their rights, to plead their cause. Shepherd of the disowned. Another cause of generational conflict that gave birth to mechanisms was youthful misbehavior. And Plutarch tells us a lot about this. Guess you can figure out what the misbehaviors were. Parties, right? Drinking, gambling, prostitutes. That's a cause of conflict. A third cause of conflict is the parents' rightful expectation
of therapeia. Can you guess what this is, therapeia? Therapy, exactly. In Greek and Roman law, it was the obligation of a child to do what? To care for their parents, especially in old age. And there are still cultures where that is the norm. My first teaching assistant as a professor was a gifted young Korean man, Yung-Soo Kim. And when his parents began to age in Seoul, South Korea, and he was here in the United States teaching, it was the expectation of his parents that he would care for them. So guess what he did? He paid for them to move here. Exactly. He brought them to the United States. And they're still living here, his parents. So in the ancient world... Yes?
But so many of them were disinherited, so those parents didn't get any benefit.
You're right, they didn't. And there were other problems with this expectation of care. If a son only had to wait for his father to what?
Die
in order to
get his
inheritance. Well, then you might actually what? Neglect or abuse in order to hasten your own economic independence. In one of these declamations, a son says to his father, I'm waiting on you to die. And the father says back to the son, keep waiting. Wait for it. So the expectation of care actually led to situations of abuse. And the figure of the father beater, the patraloios, that's the Greek word for it, was a stock character on the comic stage. The young man that beat and abused his father in order to hasten the old man's departure. Now, we've talked about the weapons in the arsenal of the father. The son had his own weapon. And in Greek, it's called dikai paranoias. Can you figure out what that means? We still have that word, paranoias. Insanity. Dikai paranoias means to have your aging parent declared what?
Insane.
Mentally incompetent. And there are lots of examples of that in the ancient world. Has anyone here read Aristophanes' comedy, The Clouds? In The Clouds, an old man wants his son to make more money for the family. So he begins to look for teachers for him. But the teachers are not very good. And so eventually the son says to his father, do you want me to have you declared insane, dikai paranoias? You know, the great Greek dramatist, tragedy writer, Sophocles, ever heard of him?
Yeah.
He wrote Oedipus Rex, right? When Sophocles became old, and he lived to be 90, by the way, he became more affectionate toward his grandson than his own son. Now, that's always a possibility in families, isn't it? My older son, who was just married about 10 days, 2 weeks ago, he has already told me that if they have a little girl, he's going to name her Lillian. Well, you know why that's important? That was my most beloved aunt. So he's already calculating, isn't he? Little Lillian will be given back to me. So Sophocles became enamored of a grandson and announced that he was going to leave all of his money
from his famous plays and the land that he owned to whom? The grandson. His son, named Yophon, dragged him into court and charged him with what? Decay paranoias, mental incompetence. And he won. He got his father's money. Finally, the last mechanism of generational conflict, and the hardest one to talk about, is violence. And we've already talked about the potential that the father could do what? Have his son put to death. We haven't talked as much about the possibility, the crime that the Romans regarded as the worst crime of all. What was it? Patricide. Right. Now, there is a disturbing volume of discourse about patricide in the literature of this period. These declamations that we were talking about, this literature that was written to train young men for the court, many of those, how many? 112 declamations are cases of patricide or contemplated patricide. Did it really happen so frequently? We have no way of knowing. No way of knowing. But what this the frequency with which this topic is discussed in the literature tells you what? People were afraid of it. It probably also tells you that even young men who did not act upon their violent desires did what? Fantasized. They thought about it. Right. Okay. I know you all have to leave. I'm sorry. Let me spend then just a few minutes talking about the circumstances of generational conflict. In all of antiquity, there were three periods when conflict between the generations flared up and grew more intense. First, democratic Athens, right? That's no surprise. Second, republican Rome. And finally, the first and second centuries AD, the very time when Clement is writing his letter. Now, what is it that characterizes these three periods? Three things. First, an underlying economic crisis in every case. That's the material cause. Second, intellectual ferment. Ideas, right? That were getting into people's heads, especially the heads of young people. And finally, the efficient cause of this was, in every case, young men. Seditious young men who decided to break free of the rule of the old. Let me say a few words about each one of these periods. Democratic Athens. The period of Athens that we admire so much was preceded by a period of severe economic crisis. The great reformer of Athenian society named Solon, he has left some writings for us, and what he tells us is that what preceded and gave birth to the democratic revolution was the spread of debt bondage. What is that? Well, yeah, when your debt became so high, your creditors had the right to what? Put you into slavery. And debt bondage was very frequent in the years before the birth of the democracy. Does that sound familiar to you? Look at our situation today. How many people are deeply in debt? The housing crisis left a lot of people in debt. People are in debt because of medical bills they can't pay. So Solon took steps to put an end to debt bondage. And one of the agents who tried to deal with the economic crisis in Athens was a radical Democrat named Ephialtes. His name is still known in Athens. When Diane and I went to Athens one time, an old man came up to us on the street and said, "Let me tell you about Ephialtes." It was a spooky moment. Now, this man's been dead for 2,000 years, but they're still talking about him on the streets in Athens. What did he do? He introduced legislation into the Athenian assembly that broke the control of the Areopagus over Greek society. What was the Areopagus, anyone? It was the Council of Elders. Exactly. It was the Council of Old Men. And so the disempowerment of the Council of Elders liberated young men to take part in politics. And another dimension of the underlying economic crisis is that the wealth that began to come into democratic Athens as Athens created an empire in the Aegean was unequally distributed. Some people, like the uncle of Plato, Critias, became fantastically wealthy. Like who? Bill Gates, right? Or who's that guy in Kansas who stock guru?
Warren
Buffett, yeah. So some people became fantastically wealthy. Other people were impoverished. So underneath the revolution that we call Democratic Athens was an economic crisis. And then I said that the second cause of the revolt of the young against the old was intellectual ferment. And that was certainly true in Democratic Athens. Does anyone here know on what charge was the philosopher Socrates condemned to death? We have the actual wording of the charge. It's preserved in Diogenes Laertius. He was charged with two great crimes that deserve the death penalty. The first was that he taught people not to worship the traditional gods of Athens. That was his first crime, a kind of atheism. Second crime, what was it? Corrupting the young. That's why Socrates was put to death. Socrates was part of the intellectual ferment that enabled the revolt of the young against the old. You wouldn't find this out by reading Plato, because Plato is Socrates' great admirer and student. But if you read any other writer of this period, Aristophanes, Polycrates, Xenophon, in all these other writers, it is clear that Socrates was guilty of the charge of stirring up the youth against their fathers. Here's how Aristophanes tells the story. You remember the young man in the clouds whose father is searching for a teacher for him? Eventually, his father finds a teacher named Socrates. And in Aristophanes' clouds, Socrates runs a school that Aristophanes calls Cloud Cuckoo Land, where young men are taught to outwit their fathers. Does anyone know how does Aristophanes' play The Clouds come to an end? The father finds out that Socrates is turning his son against him, so he goes to the school, to Cloud Cuckoo Land, and guess what he does? He burns it down. He burns down Socrates' school. There was a man who knew Socrates named Polycrates, and a couple of years after Socrates drank the hemlock, Polycrates wrote a little pamphlet called Kategoria Socratus, the accusation of Socrates. And fragments of this document survive. They are very illuminating. Socrates is accused of having taught young men that virtue, moral virtue, should be your guide in life instead of what? Parental authority. So young men are being taught to do what? Criticize their father's judgments. According to Polycrates, Socrates placed himself above the fathers, above the parents, as a moral authority. Yes?
You think we're talking about that made me think, was that the situation with Jesus vis-a-vis the runners of the temple?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. The temple authorities clearly do not like Jesus. Why not? Jesus is going around doing what? Healing people, casting out demons, telling these beautiful parables. So it must have been something else.
We say he was up usurping their authority.
Yes. You probably know the story of Jesus in the temple. He goes and takes his seat in the temple and he's teaching. And parents begin to what? Bring their
children
to Jesus. And even the disciples say what? Take them away. And Jesus says what? Suffer the little children and forbid them not to come to me. For of such is what? The kingdom of heaven. So I think you're right to understand that in the early Christian movement, the memory of Jesus and the memory of Paul, whose most trusted co-workers were young men, Timothy. Paul says, don't despise his youth, right? Titus, another young man. So in the first century, the same pattern exists. Underlying economic crisis, unequal distribution of resources, intellectual ferment, and finally, young men who decide to stand up against their elders. Because I see that my time is running out, let me mention one of the contemporaries of Paul, a Roman named Musonius Rufus. He was a Stoic teacher. He's the exact contemporary of Paul. He taught in Rome. He taught in Greek because in those days more people could speak Greek than Latin, and so he knew he would attract more students. One of his most famous essays is an essay entitled, listen to this, Must a Young Man Obey His Parents Under All Circumstances? Can you guess what he says?
No.
And he gives a lot of circumstances. And at the end of the essay, he comes to the conclusion that what young men and women ought to care about is whether they are obeying God rather than their parents. Isn't that interesting? Well, we're out of time, and I'm sorry about that. We didn't get to talk about the ideologies of age and the ideologies of youth. In the ancient world, there was a backlash against these youth movements. The elders used ideology, right, in order to reinforce the status quo. There's a lot that could be said about that. Clement, the author of this letter, is a master at the use of the ideology of age. He represents the young rebels in the church at Corinth as guilty of the worst kind of sedition. The Greek word is stasis. He He portrays the past in which the elders had authority as a golden age, which has been lost. He develops at great length a psychological analysis of the motivation of the young rebels. Guess what he says it is? Jealousy and envy. That sort of discussion of the motives of the young is also found in Plutarch, and it was a powerful ideological weapon. There's a lot more we could say about this. Unfortunately, I'm out of time. If I can convince you to come back next week, we're going to bring this to a conclusion by presenting two scenarios of the revolt against the presbyters. Two different scenarios. And I'll be asking you to decide which one makes the most sense. We're going to use everything we've learned so far. So next week will be a little bit like a whodunit mystery, right? Who did it? Who helped? What was the motivation? And I'll present two similar but different scenarios and ask you to vote so that I can give you credit in my book. Well, thanks so much for all your hard work and good attention today.
So if your conclusions are not accepted, you're going to get a letter.
That's right. That's right. And if I don't sell books.
Thank you. A lot of good job.